Well, as we continue our discussion with Ken Honda about his book, Happy Money, let's take your calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back. Ken Honda with us. His book is called Happy Money. We'll get your calls as well. Ken, did you find that people were very outgoing in talking to you as you were writing the book, or were they kind of holding back a little bit?
You mean in Japan or in North America?
Wherever you got the interviews.
Oh, so it's interesting that how people react to my book. When you talk about happy money, American media and American people ask me questions like, how can I get more money? Or how can I increase income? And whereas Japanese listeners tend to focus on, how can I satisfy with less? So even if it's a happy money, the approach is a little bit different.
What do you think causes that? Upbringing?
And also cultural thing, the more is better in American culture. And in Japan, it's more like a Zen way to satisfy with what we have is regarded as more beautiful than always asking more.
And when you started, what was your impetus for writing the book? What made you decide to do that in the first place?
You know, I retired from my baby girl for 4 years when I was 29. And about three years into my retirement, I was in the park. And I saw a mother and daughter in the playground in the park. And I saw a mother was pulling off her daughter from the swing, and she was telling her, "Mommy's got to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get out of the park." But she said, "We just got here." You know, actually, she's right. I mean, she came like 5 minutes ago, and
mom's ready to leave already, right?
Yeah. So I was a little bit upset to see what's going on, but obviously she has to work for her life, and I feel bad about myself because we've been spending the whole day there. And then I got this inspiration. If I could share what I know about happiness and money, she could stay and they could stay as long as they want in the park. So that was the start of my books.
There are some people, Ken, who have a sickness with money. They don't want to part with it.
Yes, I call them money indifferent type. So they... Well, they will want to stay away from money as far as possible, but that doesn't solve any problems because one way or another, as long as we live in the modern world, unless we live in a mountain or like somewhere in the nature, we have to deal with money.
How about as what you call the hippie? Who's that?
So the hippie people also have a very similar attitude, but money different type, there are the professors and housewives who don't deal with money. Hippie type are trying to, they have mixed feeling about money. They feel money could corrupt them.
Mm-hmm.
So they have resentment. It's a little bit different from money.
Interesting.
Different type because they're just indifferent to money.
How about the gambler?
The gambler is somebody who always find excitement in money dealings. You know, they invest in a high-risk portfolio, they lose it all, and a few years later, they gain back a lot, and then invest again, and then they lose it all.
Yeah,
so they're just going up and down. So it's so different according to your money types.
Do they ever hit it big?
Yeah, but, you know, once they make, for example, one of my friends who took his company to public, so he got like millions of dollars, but 5 years later, he lost everything, and then he started his company again. So, you know, those people who hit big, they cannot be satisfied. So they take a big risk, and they could risk everything.
Do you find that successful people don't necessarily have to make money?
I think your definition of success could be very different to an individual. For me, success means find happiness in wherever whatever you do. And real abundance is the freedom of where you want to be, who do you want to be with, and whatever you want to do. If you could follow your heart, and not too much money is needed.
All right, let's take some calls here, Ken. Let's go to Brian in Indianapolis, east of the Rockies, to get us started. Hey, Bri.
Hey, George, good morning.
Hey.
Hey, Ken, good morning. How are you, sir?
Hello. Thank you for calling in.
Good. Hey, George, I guess you classify me as a hard-working redneck, I suppose.
I wouldn't call you the redneck, but I am calling you a hard worker.
Let me tell you what, I'm working extra this morning. I came to work for a friend of mine who needed some help, so I'm working extra 3 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock, this morning. But just because of the fact that I like to make money. But it's all about hard work, it's taking a long time to get here. I'm a 21-year Teamster member. And, my dad was a 42-year UAW member here in Indianapolis.
Yep.
So the work ethic that he installed in me, and I'm the spender. Trust me, I'm the compulsive spender. My wife just beats me up daily about spending money. But, but I have a good retirement. I got an excellent retirement. My 401k is doing good. And, Ken, I was able to get into part of my retirement. And I paid off probably 10 to 12% of my credit card debt just this past year. So we're getting ready to sell our house and downsize. And, I'm about 8 or 9 more years, I'm going to retire at 66. So it's all about hard work and, keeping your nose to the grindstone, finding your own business, being in touch with the universe and karma, having good vibes and being positive.
Would you say then, Ken, you've been happy with money?
Oh, you're talking to me?
For Brian, yeah. Brian, what do you think?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy. Oh, yeah, you kidding me? I'm living life large. I mean, I got to work, but I'm living life large, And I'm cool with that. I'm a worker bee. But when I get to retirement, I expect my money to be there and my retirement funds to be there because I earned that.
Well, you'll also get Social Security when you get to that certain age, right?
Well, I'm the tail end of the baby boomers. I was born in 62, so 64 into the baby boomer generation. They're already retiring, so I'm kind of hoping that our illustrious federal government and all their infinite wisdom will try to save Social Security, not throw it.
All right. Well, good luck, Brian. There you have somebody, Ken, who's happy with his money.
Okay, great. Yes. Congratulate you, because it doesn't really matter how much you make. As long as you're happy, your life will be filled with happy memories.
How important is being smart with your money?
As Brian said, working hard is important. And also, you could work smart. And if you could work smart, that means you do what you love and exchange your services with people who like your services, you get paid more. So instead of just working as a simple labor work, if you could come up with something that would satisfy you and satisfy your clients or people around you, you can make more money. So I think working smart is very important. That doesn't mean that you can be lazy. That means you can work with more joy.
Let's go to Randy in Illinois. First time caller for Randy. Hello, Randy. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to ask Mr. Honda a question, please.
Sure. Go ahead. He's listening.
What about somebody like me? I mean, I've never really cared about money that much. As long as I've got what I need when I need it. I'm 62 years old. I'm retired. I have my retirement pay from the Navy. I have my Social Security. I don't have an IRA. I don't have I don't have a giant savings account. I'm good to go.
But you're getting by on your Navy pension, at least, aren't you?
Oh yeah, I can make do.
And by the way, thanks for serving, Randy.
Well, thank you for serving, George.
Thank you. What do you think, Ken? He's happy.
Yes, I'm just so happy that we're getting happy callers. So, first of all, I want to congratulate you for being happy, and that doesn't mean that you need to make extra money. But if you have some time, why don't you explore something that will make you happy and be service of other people? So if you could find something that excites you more and then possibly receive financially that gives you a lot of meaning in life, and also receive some other incomes. And that way, if you just want to do extra travels or something, it's going to subside for that.
All right. Good for you, Randy. Just keep doing your thing. And at what point do people become unhappy because they don't have enough money, Kenny?
I think if you are in a survival mode, like even if you work so many hours and you can't pay bills, I think you feel resentment. But oftentimes, if you don't have the right education, if you fall into a bad place, that could happen too. But for most people, if you have a good job, I mean, not just super paying job, if you are working regular jobs, you can make both ends meet. And if you cannot do that, probably you're spending too much. A lot of people spend on unnecessary things and waste money. That is the cause of their money stretch.
Go to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you.
Thank you, Frank.
I don't know if I'm happy or not. I make good money, and my wife retired for health reasons. And I'm the type of guy that I like nice things, but I'm not going to pay a ridiculous price for it. I wouldn't buy a Rolex watch if I was a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
But a few months ago, I found a wallet. You're not going to believe this. It had over $2,500 in it.
Mm.
$100 bills, a few 50s, some 20s. I had to open it up to find out who it was to get it back to them. So I found it on the parking lot of my job. So and the day I found it, I had only 80 cents in my pocket. So I took it to the office, and one of the supervisors said, I don't know this guy, but I know his father because he looks like his father. The young man was 25 years old. He came into the building crying. He said, did anybody see my wallet or find a wallet? I said, man, and naturally, I'm the first one he sees.
Yeah.
He said, go to the office. Jack has got your a wallet. And he was about 25 years old. And I said, man, why do you carry that much in your pocket if you're not going to pay a bill or something with it? He said it was his mortgage payment. He was already behind by one, and this was a mortgage payment, most of it. And I said, well, get yourself a wallet like the bikers do, that if you drop it, it won't drop far.
And it's chained to your pants.
And my wife is so frivolous, I offer to buy her clothes, and she'll accept hand-me-downs from her sisters, who are, you know, more well-to-do. So I don't know if I'm happy or not.
Well, what do you mean, Franco? What do you mean you don't know if you're happy or not? You should.
I have everything I need. I make enough money, and I'm not. I don't go in for $1,000 suits. I like nice clothes, but jewelry. I don't understand the worth of jewelry, so I don't go in for gaudy jewelry. $100 watch is good enough for me.
So I think you are a happy person. You just don't know it. So I want you to feel that you're so blessed with what you need to have. So don't be influenced by what's going on in marketing system. You know, we are so brainwashed to feel that unless we buy expensive cars, expensive jewelry, watches, you know, we don't mean anything. But I think you're so happy.
Well, first of all, most of us get our times right off our smartphones now.
Mm, yeah.
They're there. So
you don't need a watch.
You really don't need a watch. It's jewelry. And like Frank, I mean, I wouldn't spend thousands of dollars on a watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's not worth it.
Yeah. So, you know, if you like expensive watches, it's okay too. But I think
if you can afford it.
Yeah. But you seem very happy. It's just, I don't know why you say, I don't know. But I hope you get it, because it doesn't cost you anything to feel happy.
Let's go to Peter in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the program. Hi, Peter. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, this is Peter James, George. I want to thank you. Coast to Coast saved a life. Real quickly, a comment before I ask Mr. Honda about my money question.
Yeah.
I'm the one that's stage five that's looking for a kidney. James needs a kidney at Weebly.com.
Right.
And a lady went in, I know I'm on the prayer list with you all, and I think that's what saved her and saved me. She went into the University of Colorado Medical Center to get tested, and guess what, George?
She's a match?
She was a match, but they found out she had cancer.
Oh, no.
On one of her things, but they got it at a level, just at early stages, and they said they're going to be able to take care of her. I want her to call in tomorrow to get on the air to thank people for being on the list. That's my comment. Thank you, George.
Okay, and in terms of money, you seem happy, huh, Peter?
Yes, I'm happy. I've taken care of myself, but I have a question about evil and money. There's a relative of mine, her mother and father were into the occult, Satanism, and that's how they made their money. And she's had the worst luck with that, her inheritance. She's even had a son who had committed suicide, and the only other son got on heroin. And my question is, can evil travel with money? And if so, is there any way to clean that money up? And George, thank you again. I'll take my answer off air.
Okay, Peter. I think evil can track money, don't you think, Ken?
Yeah, that's like unhappy money. When you receive an unhappy money with bad energy, that could be contagious. That not only makes you feel sick, both physically and emotionally, that will make the other people feel sick too. That's why I think I call it a happy money cleansing is necessary. You know, when you appreciate the money, when you receive it, and then just imagine that the money is going to make you feel happy and also make the person that you're spending money to, handing the money to, also happy, you can do the cleansing. But unless you do that, you just pass it on about luck, in other words.
Ken, the subtitle of your book, Happy Money, is The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. What is that Japanese art?
I think it's more of a Zen attitude to find whatever you have is enough. We are so brainwashed to ask more, do more, be more. But if we find that we have more than enough, and if we start appreciating what we have, we can find happiness instantly. My mentor Wahe said, you can focus on money worries and money gratitude at the same time, because our mind can only conceive one thing. So just fill your mind and heart with gratitude. So if you did that, it's hard to focus on money worries.
Somebody like Warren Buffett, is he happy?
I think he's a very happy person because he doesn't need a big mansion. He's very comfortable with the house he bought like 50 years
ago. Yeah, exactly. Or the late Sam Walton would drive a little pickup truck. He liked it.
Right. And also Bill Gates. I'm sure he lives in a big house, but he knows his money can do miracles in the world. So that's why he's donating a lot of money to charity. So the people who know how to share, even though it doesn't really matter how much you share, it's just an attitude and feeling that, you know, if you share something, even a dollar or two, that gives you a happy feeling. So I hope all the listeners start sharing a dollar or two or more if you feel like it.
Absolutely.
I can guarantee that'll make you very happy.
Ken, thank you so much. The name of the book, Happy Money, and you can find it all over the place, including Amazon.com. His website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, a little tribute to our dear friend, the late Stanton Friedman. Our dear friend, the late ufologist Stanton Friedman, passed away several weeks ago at the age of 84. I had the great pleasure of being with him in Columbus, Ohio, the day before he died. And people have been emailing me saying, we still want to hear Stanton, please, one more time. We'll probably use him again, but here he was in 2007 versus the skeptic Michael Shermer. Well, tonight, the skeptic's cage to go in. One comes out. Who will it be? Stanton Friedman, the ufologist, or Dr. Michael Shermer, the skeptic? Okay, two guests for you. Stanton Friedman, he received his BS and MS degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 56, where Carl Sagan was a classmate. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet, General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas on such advanced, highly classified, eventually canceled projects such as nuclear aircraft fission and fusion rockets. Since 1967, he has lectured on the topic of UFOs. He's been all over the country, all over the world. Stanton Friedman was with me and Michael Shermer on the Larry King Show a few weeks ago. Hey, Stanton, how are you?
Well, it's a good morning here. I figured out some puzzles. I'm happy.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And Dr. Michael Shermer, of course, is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's the director of the Skeptic Society, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptic's Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology. He also edits skeptic.com. Dr. Shermer received his BA degree in psychology from Pepperdine University, his MA in experimental psychology from California State University, and his PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He too is with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Michael. Welcome
back. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good to have you both with us. And of course, when we were on the Larry King Show, Stanton and Michael were in the corner swinging at each other. I had to break it up. Only kidding, guys. Only kidding.
Throwing chairs.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Michael, how did you have a good time on the King Show? What'd you think?
Oh, those shows are always frustrating because they're fairly short and everybody talks over one another. I found one of the most amusing things was emails I got days afterwards from fellow skeptics who said, the other guys kept talking over you. How come you weren't more aggressive? And then from UFO people had said, how come you kept interrupting the UFO people? You were so rude.
And too aggressive.
So we all filter these things through our own biases, I think.
Stanton, how about you? What kind of a time did you have on the King Show?
Well, it was a frustrating is a good word for it. Too many people, no chance to finish thoughts. I got asked why the cover-up. I said there are six reasons in the article on my website, and I gave one, and suddenly we were someplace else. That was frustrating, and, you know, it's not a good way to get at truth when you got so many people talking so quickly on such a diverse collection of topics. You know, I admire Buzz Aldrin, but I didn't think a lesson on how the rocket works was, you know, very useful.
Yeah, and that was going to go on and on and on, too.
Yes.
Well, tonight what we'll do is we'll have a friendly discussion on why, Stanton, you believe in the existence of USOs, UFOs, and you, Michael, why you believe that we don't. But you look at things as, are you a debunker or a skeptic? There's a big difference, Michael.
Yeah, big difference. Skepticism is just a tool. It's not a thing. It's not a position you take. I don't think of it as a noun. I think of it more as a verb, that it's just a way of analyzing claims. You can be skeptical of a claim. You can be skeptical of the skeptics. Global warming certainly comes to mind. There are people that are skeptical of global warming, and there are people that are skeptical of the so-called global warming skeptics. And that's a nice example, I think, of a current event that shows it really is just a way of analyzing claims, and people can differ on how they use the tool. So in the case of UFOs and SETI and so forth, you know, it isn't a position to take. There's, you know, several different questions to ask. Are they out there? Have they come here? What is the quality of the evidence for each of the different kinds of claims? And you have to take them one at a time, and it would be obviously dogmatically closed-minded to just say, well, I just don't believe, period. You don't believe what? I mean, you have to take them one claim at a time. And that's what we try to do at Skeptic with all the different things, like alternative medicine. I mean, there's thousands of claims. You can't just say, I don't believe any of them. You have to, you know, look at each one of them.
Well, we've got a lot of time on this program, unlike Larry had. So let us start with you, Stanton, and I'll just give you a moment of opening remarks on why you're a believer.
Well, I'm not a believer. I'm a scientist who's been looking at the data for 49 years, been lecturing about it for 40 years, which gives me plenty of feedback. It's overall evidence that Michael never deals with, and I actually figured out tonight why he makes extraordinary claims, like that there's that only anecdotal evidence, for example, or no security aspect of this, and I figured all that out. basically, I've reached four major conclusions. One, the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some underlined 37 times, some UFOs are alien spacecraft, most are not. Don't care about them. Secondly, that we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate, meaning some few people within the major governments of the planet have known since at least 1947 when two craft were recovered in southeastern New Mexico, alien craft and alien bodies, that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft. The third conclusion is that there are no good arguments against a flying saucer reality, against the first two conclusions, only people who haven't looked at the evidence, such as Michael. And fourth, we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. Not two millennia, one millennia. Visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft, successful cover-up of the best data bodies and wreckage for 60 years. That's quite remarkable. So that, in a nutshell, is where I stand. And in my lectures, of course, I go through evidence. Now, we don't have time for me to present a bunch of slides, even if I hold them close to the telephone, you won't see them. So we'll deal with evidence as we go along and my solution to why Michael makes extraordinary claims, and we'll get on with
it. All right. And Michael, why are you the skeptic?
Well, again, I separate the two major questions. Are extraterrestrial intelligences out there somewhere in the cosmos, and have they come here? And obviously the answer to the first question is nobody knows. We have to keep looking, listening, searching, sending out spacecraft, using radio telescopes and so on, like the SETI program does. And like most of the SETI scientists, I would say, you know, it would be remarkable if we were alone. I mean, as Carl Sagan liked to say, you know, what a considerable waste of space. And it would be rather egocentric and narrow-minded of us to think that we're special, we're alone. You know, the Copernican principle here applies, that we're not special, that if it happened here, it likely happened elsewhere. The raw numbers by themselves, the, you know, 100 billion galaxies, you know, 100 billion stars in each one of them, and let's say only 10%, but probably more, have planets, mm-hmm. You just end up with a probability of close to one that there has to be extraterrestrial intelligence somewhere out there. And I'm not talking just about bacterial-grade life, but actual intelligence.
So you believe that?
Yeah, I don't believe it. Okay, that's a word.
That's my favorite word.
I think it's highly probable, although we have no evidence of it yet, so we have to just keep looking.
But you don't believe it's here.
I'm here. No, I think there's a lot of good arguments against the idea that they've come here, and if they have, they wouldn't resemble anything like what you typically see in the narratives of alien abduction experiences and those sorts of things, where there are bipedal primates that are bilaterally symmetrical with two arms and two legs and a head and two eyes and so forth. That, I mean, that only happened once in the, you know, 4 billion year history of Earth and of the trillions of species that have evolved and gone extinct. Only one lineage has become bipedal primates, us. And so the idea that that happened somewhere else is pretty improbable, and that they then happen to find us in the, you know, vast emptiness of the cosmos, that makes it seem even more unlikely. And therefore, the terrestrial hypothesis that people are having psychological experiences, sleep disorders, hallucinations, illusions, their creative, fantasy-prone personalities, whatever, concocting stories of aliens that look like us, that seems more probable than the previous scenario.
Last hour of the program, when we go to phone calls, so we would have had 2 hours of this debate. I'll open up the fast blasts, and we'll have listeners vote without trying to skew anything. We'll just take them as they come in on who they felt won tonight's Skeptics Cage debate. I remember, Stanton, when you did the first one with Seth Shostak, you won, did you not?
Well, it was 57-33-10. I didn't get a prize, though, George.
No, the prize has not come yet. The prize actually will be doing a full show with you on your Betty Hill book.
Okay.
How about that?
I can put up with that as a prize. I mean, I've read the book. I don't think Michael has. Michael read the book?
I don't know. You had it with you, right?
Betty Hill book.
I'm going to break down tonight's debate in different areas and concepts. And Michael, you basically have started the first one for us, and that is, there's no question that this universe has billions of planets in there, and that the possibility of life out there is pretty strong. Let's address that first and foremost, not whether we've been visited or not, but life out there. Stanton, of course, being the scientist who believes in visitation, obviously then you're the believer in life out there elsewhere. But I want you to elaborate as a scientist why you believe there are many planets out there inhabited by intelligent beings.
Well, you know, I can't come to a conclusion as to how many are inhabited by intelligent beings. Unlike Michael, I don't think it's probable or improbable. When you don't have data, you might as well throw darts at a dartboard. The simple fact of the matter is there are bipedal beings coming here. Now, how many planets out there have life? We don't know. We do have to take into account, though, that the distribution of life, even on our planet, is related to things like colonization and migration. So if it starts at one place, it could move on all over the place. And we don't know. It's like SETI. You know that I've said that SETI is like silly effort to investigate, because when you look at the Drake equation, there's no way to put in numbers. We don't know what fraction of planets develop life. We don't know what fraction of those develop intelligence, or what fraction of those send signals. It's not an equation. There's no way to put numbers in it. The estimates vary from a few thousand to a few billion. That tells you it isn't a description of Mother Nature or of the world around us. It's dartboard physics. As a scientist, I believe in dealing with the real-world physics. And so, you know, life out there, sure, it's coming here. I don't know where. I have some ideas where some of it might come from, but we cannot make statements about the distribution of life out there because nobody's given us a map. Yeah, there are a bunch of civilizations over in this corner and a bunch over there. These guys have been fighting those guys. These guys have settled up over here. We don't know. That's look. I'm a scientist, not a writer. Michael's a good writer. He's a good stand-up comedian. I watch some of his stuff on YouTube. But that's different from science. You have to say you don't know. I have a huge gray basket. I know that the evidence is that there are critters, if you will, coming here in manufactured craft. That doesn't mean I know why, who, how. I mean, I try to deal with these questions on my website and elsewhere. But we cannot make any statements about how common or how rare, because we haven't picked up a signal. Using our equipment, we presume that aliens are stuck at our level of technology. I find that an extraordinary claim. What basis do we have? And we know how quickly our technology has evolved. Look at the past 110 years or so. You know, flight and radio and microwaves and DNA and a whole slew of things in a lousy 100 years. So what if somebody got started a little bit before we did, you know, say 10,000 years?
Michael, your turn.
Well, the SETI program with the so-called Drake equation, you know, this is just a first approximation to get our minds around thinking about how best to try to make contact if there is some intelligence out there. So while it's true for some of the components of the equation, such as how many planets typically give life, you know, we have no idea. But some of the other parts of the equation are getting more refined. For example, the number of planets, the number of stars that have planets, the number of G-type stars like ours that have planets and so forth. I mean, we've discovered now over about 250 extrasolar system planets. And so it's giving us a good approximation that at least 10% of every star in the galaxy has planets. And that's probably a conservative estimate. So we can thereby start to make slightly more refined probability guesses that, well, you know, probably the chances are even more that there's extraterrestrial life out there. That's, in, you know, sort of a plus for both SETI and, I suppose, the UFO community. And, you know, when they launch Kepler in a few years, and it'll be able to find planets around stars the size, or be able to find planets the size of Earth, not just Jupiter size. The only reason we find Jupiter-sized planets is because that's the level of sophistication of the technology. So, but what I just told you is not anything that any SETI scientist would tell you. That wouldn't tell you. I mean, Seth Shostak's been on your show.
Sure.
He would say everything I just said, and he would not make any claims about we know or we don't know. And I mean, what Seth and all the SETI scientists say is we have to look. We don't know. Nobody knows. And these are just the first approximations. And I'm not sure why Stan is degrading or putting down the SETI program. I don't know what the purpose of that is. I mean, they're not making any particular claims. They're just looking.
Yes, they are making a particular claim. They're claiming that nobody's coming here, but if we want to find extraterrestrial intelligence, we got to look for a signal.
I don't think they make any claims about that unless you ask them. I mean, they've never published anything like we hereby declare we don't think people have come here.
But, I mean, they've said that, though, Michael.
If you ask them, I suppose they'd say, yeah, I doubt it, like something along
I would say.
But that's not part of the SETI program. The SETI program is just a scientific search. And whether they come here or not is not part of their paradigm. They're not looking for aliens here.
When there's evidence that there are aliens here, and we have no evidence, as you have said, and I've agreed, we really have no evidence about what's going on out there, all we can do is look at what's coming here. We don't
Obviously, Stan, they don't agree with that, too. Obviously, they don't agree that there's evidence that they've come here. If they did...
You haven't looked at the evidence. That's one of the most remarkable aspects.
I completely disagree with you there, and... I would recommend to your listeners a terrific book on this subject called Roswell by Carl Flock, who I believe you've had on the show, George.
Mm-hmm.
He's a UFO believer now. He believes aliens have come here, are coming here. And this is an
hardly a UFO book.
He completely debunks all of the Roswell stuff and really shows, I think, with great intellectual courage and honesty, how easy it is to filter out evidence that supports what you want to believe.
By website vote, Stanton was the winner. I miss him. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borrells, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.